dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we began a series of presentations from the first U.S. conference on peak oil and community solutions, held in Yellow Springs, Ohio, earlier this month. This week, we'll continue with more material from the conference and begin to shift the focus from understanding the ecological context and the ramifications to industrial civilization of declining supplies of fossil fuels to solutions for surviving and even thriving in an era of scarce energy. I hope you'll be able to record this material and pass it on to others who may not be hearing this broadcast. The U.S. political and corporate establishment began to address issues of oil scarcity as far back as the mid-20th century, and at every opportunity since then chose the path of increasing consumption backed by overt militarism and covert neocolonial strategies involving the establishment of dictatorial puppet regimes ready to guard U.S. access to oil, a pattern that continues in the latest round of resource wars in the Middle East. In the first hour of the program, the geopolitics of oil with Pat Murphy, Director of Community Services, host organization of the conference. In the second hour, we address the possibilities of homegrown energy in the form of ethanol with permaculturist David Bloom. MC Megan Quinn of Community Services introduces the morning session of the conference.
The first module we're going to begin with is the consequences of consumption. It really started last night with Richard's talk, and it's going to continue this morning with Pat's talk on the geopolitical implications. And then David Bloom will start us on the solution track, the hopeful track. Let's get started today. I'm honored to introduce back up here Pat Murphy.
Good morning. I'm going to talk a little bit, kind of a continuation of what Richard was talking about. Our focus here is on solutions, and particularly community solutions, and that's the focus of all the following speakers, including me tomorrow when I talk about my view of solutions. However, it's really important for us to get very, very clear on what the problem is, because if we don't really understand things and if we have to act suddenly, then if we have solving the wrong problem, we'll may not have time to recorrect. So I want to go into a little bit more about the geopolitical implications, because although Richard touched on it, I think we have to study this just a little bit more in depth. And what I'm going to do is summarize a brief history of the world from the perspective of what's important about oil. Then I'll talk about equity in energy and the economics of oil and how it relates to equity. OPEC, our favorite people we don't like. The question of who actually owns the world's oil, or at least the rest of it, half of it being gone, as Richard pointed out last night. I'll speak a little bit about our new national doctrine of preemption and the possibility of nuclear war, and this then lists some of the choices. And one of the choices, the choice which I actually favor and advocate and work for, is sustainable low-energy communities. I think today's problems, including the oil problems, are very much historical. I think they go back... Actually, I think they go back a few centuries to the period of colonialism, but a good place to start is the famous Berlin Conference of 1898. Discuss a little bit about the post-World War II and the Sykes-Picot division of the Middle East, and then the Balfour Declaration, which was a decision to establish the Jewish state in the Middle East. Talk about the implications of oil in World War II, and then today's situation. My view is not that we have some class of civilizations of Christians versus Muslims, that it's really a war for the control of shrinking oil resources and actually a continuation of colonialization. So I want to begin with the conference in 1898, which is the Conference of Berlin. This conference was called because as the Western powers, particularly Britain and France, were splitting up Africa, they were running into contention. One person wanted to take this particular African territory, and the other nation said, we want to take it. So you had a situation where it was partitioning Africa was sort of inefficient. So this conference was called in 1898, and it's actually divided up Africa between the Western powers, which today is sort of a fascinating concept. How do you take a continent and divide it amongst the Western powers? But we did that. The United States was part of the Berlin Conference. It did not take any of Africa. In 1898, it was the same year that we declared war on Spain, and we took Cuba, Puerto Rico, all the islands in the Pacific, Guam, Midway, and also in 1898 was when we liberated Hawaii and took control of that country. And finally, the Philippines. But in this division, and I didn't list of all of Africa, but and all I'm really focusing on is the oil countries. Britain took Nigeria, one of the big oil producers. France took Algeria up here, and Italy took Libya. And if you recall, Libya's been one of our enemies. Nigeria's pretty complacent. This really showed the weakness of the Ottoman Empire, which was collapsing. And it really set a lot of world conditions for a century. And this is the beginning of oil growth. Only a few years before, the automobile had been invented, and we were already starting that move for the automobile. And by the way, from the automobile, it pretty quickly came the tank. It was only a few years later that Wilbur and Orville Wright flew their airplane, and we started developing bombing, which has been perfected to a fine degree. So 1898 was really a key effort. And we immediately can look back in terms of the class of civilizations. By the way, Nigeria is over 50% Muslim. Algeria and Libya are about 99%. So we already have a certain sense of class of civilizations for those who don't enjoy being occupied. In 1916, this is after the First World War, in which the Ottoman Empire came in on the wrong side. They lost, and they lost big. And the British and French took over the what we call a lot of the Middle East today. There was the blue zone that went to France, the A zone that was kind of divided, and the red zone went to Britain. And this is the red zone, which we also know as Iraq today. If you talk to anyone in the Middle East, like if you talk to someone in Afghanistan about Britain, they say, oh, this is the fourth British-Afghan war, because there's a whole history of Britain having these wars. And, of course, the Iraqis are very familiar with being occupied by the British. The British Navy had made a key decision to convert to oil in 1912 because the Royal Navy was still helping Britain control the world. And at that point, they no longer could just use their coal resources, and they were pretty much committed to controlling the Middle East. Then in 1970, we had the Balfour Declaration, which we're all still living with today, in which Britain decided they would establish a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. This is well before World War II. That didn't sit too well with the Arabs and is still a point of contention today. I want to talk a little bit about the size of the British Empire, and this is just the British Empire. If I laid the French and others on top of that, you'd get a real strong sense of how much the world was under the control, particularly of Europe. But here's Britain. And looking at the Middle East, how much control they had here, plus this section going into India, and of course Nigeria, today's one of the leading producers today. Seeing their control of the Middle East, and recall that Britain had been occupying India for many, many years, and they had protected all these transportation routes. So even before the First World War, Britain had a major influence in that part of the world, and then afterwards they ended up running Iraq and Palestine, with the French taking the countries north of that. Britain and France had a lot to do with organizing the Middle East. You know, when we look back at things like Africa and we say, well, these people are really contentious, they don't get along, and somehow they have warring tribes. And it seems to me sometimes as the people at the Home Office in Britain probably said, if we're going to divide a country, let's find some warring tribes and we'll sort of center the division around that. So that'll be a gift that we give them because we're not going to, say, form around the people. And so this is a map, and I won't go into detail, but you can see the partition of the Ottoman Empire amongst the Western powers, with a little bit going to Russia and some of it left for the modern state of Turkey. I want to jump past that period. That was the sort of pre-war and between the wars, and bring us up to World War II. Now, Richard pointed out last night that in 1930, we reached our U.S. oil discovery peak. And by the way, I'm of the opinion that people that run governments and get elected and become presidents are normally pretty smart people, and they don't miss things. And so the people that were running this country were not unaware that oil had peaked in 1930, and they saw this start going down. In 1941, one of the great moments in history was when the United States and Britain set up an oil embargo against Japan. And I think this led directly to the Pearl Harbor attack, in that when this was established, Japan had something like 3 or 4 months worth of oil, and they had no oil of their own. And at that point, they had the decision to either acquiesce and pull out of Korea and Manchuria, which was the demands of the United States and Britain, or to continue, and they chose to continue. So the attack on Pearl Harbor was not a beginning of the conquest of the United States, but a destruction of the Pacific Fleet that allowed them then to go south into Indonesia. So if you look at the history of that, Pearl Harbor, and then all the Japanese Navy went south to take control of, well, first the Philippines and then into Indonesia, which is where the oil was. And although I don't want to talk too much about it, but the basic strategy of the United States Navy was to just shoot all the oil tankers down, and at the end of the war, Japan was pretty much out of oil. In 1943, Henry Ickes warned Roosevelt, "We're running out of oil." He was a very, very smart guy and very familiar with the situation with oil, and he pointed out that that we had peaked, that oil was a key part of our strategy, and that we really had to do something about that. Well, Roosevelt got that, clearly understood it, and in 1949, with a famous meeting with Ibn Saud, who was the head of the Saudi royal family, that's when we were guaranteed U.S. access to the oil. Now, what's access mean? That means we can get that oil when we need it and also at the price we need it. The situation there really, although we had been fighting a war for democracy, one of our first actions was to guarantee that democracy would not enter into the country of Saudi Arabia. Then we had the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe, which was to a certain extent rebuilding the colonial powers. We formed the OEEC, which was the predecessor of the OECD, which I'm going to be talking about later. This is basically just reconstructing Europe and adding Japan to it. So now, in terms of the efforts to maintain the colonialism, from 1945 we had an amazing number of wars of national liberation. And this is just trying to get these European powers out of the Asian and African countries. One of the interesting things, and I focused a lot on Indonesia because this was a very oil-rich country, is at the end of the war, the Dutch had been driven out after occupying Indonesia for a couple of centuries. Again, Indonesia is a country that's about 99% Muslim. And they said, well, we don't have the power to get back and take charge of this country. And Britain said, we'll help you out, but we're short of soldiers. So they took a lot of the Japanese captures, the prisoners of wars, and gave them arms, and then went and tried to put down the Indonesian uprising, which didn't work. But this was always basically Asia and Africa against Britain and France. Then we had the Vietnam War, which was an attempt really to reinstate French control, and that passed to the United States, and there were 3 million Southeast Asians killed in this period. So things have been pretty bloody. Then there are a lot of other aggressive acts against the Muslim countries. Algeria, another one of the major oil-producing countries, they revolted against the French from 1954 to 1962, and there were somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people killed. Now we enter the post-World War II, and I'm just talking now about the unique United States history. First, we agreed to a permanent dynasty, no democracy for the Saudis. Then in 1948, we helped establish Israel in Palestine, and then over the years, the OECD, largely France and the United States and others, made sure Israel had nuclear weapons technology. We may have forgotten that one of our current favorite enemies, which is Iran, part of the axis of evil, they had elected a democratic president, Mossadegh, who nationalized the oil companies, and that took care of him. So he was overthrown by the British United States and the Shah of Iran imposed. I keep pointing out that you'll hear that we really got to make the Middle East safe for democracy, but any effort at democracy was normally put down. In 1965, coming back to this other oil-rich country and also a Muslim country, and I get these names mixed. What, there were Suharto and Sukarno. These are the two figures, and just bear with me if I get the order wrong. But one of them was attempting to socialize his nation, and he was overthrown, and a dictator was placed in there, which I think he got ousted within the last 5 years. The popular people's movement, there were at least 500,000 people killed, and the CIA had provided some of the hit list for this. Then in 1980, there had been late 70s revolution by Khomeini, in which the Shah was ousted, and at this point, Iran was out of control, another major oil-producing country, and the United States supported Saddam Hussein in invading Iran. And if you really look at some of this history, Saddam Hussein was a guy that was unpleasant, but was, you know, keeping things under control, and he decided to invade Iran, and well, nobody got too excited. But then we decided to invade Kuwait, then we got very excited. So it's not really the question of Saddam Hussein invading other countries to get their oil, but it's which ones they actually invade. Then in 1980, Sudan is another has minimal oil, but another Muslim country, and that's when President Clinton bombed the pharmaceutical plant there, and the German ambassador did some studies and said there were tens of thousands of resultant deaths because it was the only pharmaceutical plant the country had. In the Iraq history, we've had the first Iraq Gulf War, 100 to 200,000 people killed, Iraqis killed. I think our casualties were something like 18. At the end of that war, the Shiites, which we probably all know now as 65% of the population, they were revolting. But also remember, Iran is also Shiites, so that's the wrong Islam group. So at that point, there was a great opportunity to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They were encouraged to revolt, but then they revolted and asked for weapons, and those were held back, so that was another massacre. Then in this 1991 to 2002, we had the Iraqi embargo of just about everything, and that's been pretty well documented that about 1 million people died as a result of that. And Madeleine Albright is still trying to live down the statement when she was interviewed on television, and that was at the point where there were only about 500,000 dead. And somebody asked, well, or the report says, was it worth it? She says, yes, the price was worth it. Now, in recent times, there's been a report that came out by some extremely courageous people from John Hopkins and another American university that went in there and started trying to figure out what the death rates were. And if you read their story where they're hiding in the back of cars because they didn't know who wanted to kill them worse, but they put that together, and there's 100,000 Iraqis that have been killed. This fits, by the way, the typical colonial war rate. I think I remember the British used to have a statement about one Englishman is worth 100 wogs and two Frenchmen are worth 100 wogs. And that basically was kind of the white man mentality, at least at that time in history. So we have this situation where, from the perspective of Muslims, the other side of the clash of civilization, they're dying a lot through these battles with the Western powers. So the Western powers, they've encroached on the Muslim world for a couple of centuries. Britain and France took control of the Middle East, and then the United States took it. We installed this country of Europeans in Israel. At the time, Ibn Saud said to Roosevelt, "Well, I can understand that these Jews should have their own country because they were horribly treated by these Western powers, like Russia was did a lot of persecution, and then of course when Hitler came in, it was a bloodbath. If the current size of the state of Israel would have been 6% of Germany, so he said, why don't you take this nice area along the Baltic and give them a chunk of Germany?" But again, that was refused. So our world tensions are not, in my opinion, a clash of civilization. It's a war for shrinking oil resources and sort of a continuation of the old colonial period. I'm going to develop this a little bit by talking about world equity and energy, and I'll mention a little bit about the major world alliances. I'm going to talk about things from a per capita perspective. We have a tendency to say, well, this nation has most of this or this nation has less of that, but you can't really compare, let's say, China as a nation and say, well, they use this against someone like, Cuba, which has 11 million people. You have to start putting some things on a per capita basis, and we rarely do that. And I'm going to talk also about some of the trends so we get a sense of where are we going and what's the direction that this oil-based society is moving. I'm going to bring up a couple of very challenging ideas. That is, the more energy available in the world, or the more energy that's used, the more inequity we have. This was first pointed out by Ivan Illich in his essay, Energy Inequity, which, by the way, you can easily get on the website, because he was writing about and during the 1970s oil crisis. And if you do a little study of history going back before free trade appeared and look at major areas like China, India, and Europe, you'll find roughly the same standard of living. It was a set of people that had their own, I think the Chinese did better at some manufacturing, and the Indians were really good at textiles. But overall, there wasn't this huge inequity in the world that exists today. And next, I'm going to point out that wealth is a measure of fossil fuel consumption more than any other single thing. I point out that this is more correlative than causal. I don't have any proof of that, but I'll just have to develop the thesis and you can judge. Is Eric Lang here? I actually put that in because Eric called me on it in a presentation a year ago, so I wanted to make sure. Oh, there you are. I wanted to make sure I had it was correlative, not causal. So some of the key indicators that we can look at in the world is for any country is what's the size of the population, the lifespan, and how much do people make? Because, you know, income is very important to us all. And so I'll be talking and showing you a brief summary of that. I'll talk about energy usage per capita, because if I make a claim that wealth is based on oil, then maybe on a per capita basis we could see they should correlate. Discuss the Gini Index, which is basically a measure of inequity, and talk about military expenditures, also per capita. And first, I want to talk about, I'll be breaking the world up in these two major organizations, the OECD, which is that historical derivative from the Marshall Plan and from the original OEEE. And it's basically the G7, the really powerful countries that run the world, United States, UK, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and Japan. It's interesting to notice that after we had this great war, that the people that ended up as part of the committee to run it were the enemies that we defeated, Germany and Japan. This is 30 nations with 18% of the population and most of Europe, 21 continental Europe. All the Anglo-American states, the derivatives from the British Empire, US, Canada, UK, Australia, and New Zealand. Two Asian states, Japan and South Korea, places where we fought great wars in the last century. And then a couple of French states, Mexico and Turkey. And If you look at it, you always need a place close by to get a source of labor, and Turkey served that for Europe, and Mexico does it for the United States. And these are the rich nations. The rest of the world is 82% of the population. It includes OPEC, the petroleum exporting country, which you might think, well, aren't they rich? But we'll go into that later. And it's basically the poor nations. And this is a map of that of the world. And you see it's the United States. Unfortunately, this doesn't have Mexico highlighted, but they're included. And then here's Europe, and then Australia and Japan. So they're kind of scattered around, but they all have similar characteristics. Either they were European powers, a defeated enemy, but certainly good industrial powerhouses. So this is my chart, which I developed, called the World Hierarchy of Wealth and Power. And you start out the United States at the top. To me, it's important because we all want to live a long life. So lifespan is really important. How long do people live? And we do very well in the United States, but not as well as the G7 without the United States. We have then the OECD, and here's the populations, 280 million, roughly 400 each, and the rest of the world. And the rest of the world has a pretty, they don't live, like they're about 10 years short of what the Western powers live. Here's the income, $36,000 per person at the top. This is based on a United Nations measure of the PPP. And then down here at the rest of the world, about one-ninth or one-tenth of that. Then we have the barrels of oil, BOE. If you study much more about oil, you'll hear about barrels of oil equivalent, BOE, because it's easier to talk about that than to add up how much oil, natural gas, oil, shale, and coal you're using. And you can see this huge difference here that steps down. And if you divide this number by this number, you come in a very, very narrow band. One of my points that wealth and energy consumption are roughly the same. Here's the Gini Index. The United States, when we're looking at this group, now that it's the most unequal nation. By the way, the higher the number, the less equal, the more unequal things are. So this is very high in our nation. Even though in the rest of the world it's fairly low, but there are spots in the world like the ex-Russian countries and places in South America where it's much worse. And here's military expenditures per capita. So we here in the United States are spending about $1,400 per year, and over there in India and China and others, the average citizen is spending about $28. And I summarize all these into the two divisions of the world, which I use the OECD versus the rest of the world. Big difference in lifespan, big difference in income, big difference in energy used, and major difference in military expenditures. Looking at this on a percentage basis, 18% of the population, about 60% of the wealth, 55% of the energy, and 82% of the military expenditures. So this division shows some wild extremes. I want to give you just an example of what some of these things imply. If we come back to energy use, barrels of oil equivalent, here we are at 60, and immediately this country is always about twice, this country in Canada, about twice what the European nations in Japan. Stepping on down, China, which we all read in the paper every day, is just burning up oil and making cars. They've taken a big jump, and the average Chinese person is using about one-tenth of what we use. India, much less than that, like 1/25th. And then countries like Bangladesh are down to the point of almost being as almost 100-to-1 ratio. Now, that doesn't look too good, but we all know that globalization is helping the whole world. And we've been taking this approach, and since 1980, things have really taken off. I don't remember the exact time when the world trade was passed, but presumably globalization should be helping narrow that gap. And this is what you can see. This is simply a division of the wealth of the world, the yearly income. And in 1960, the top 20% took 70%. Now they're taking 89%. And you can see where the bottom's gone. The Gini index of inequity is gone up, and the ratio of the top to the bottom fifths has been accelerating. So if you look at what's happened, and actually it's really much worse in the last 20 years. Here you jumped 6%, but here you jumped 13%. So the situation that we that the world finds itself in this sense of terms of globalization and competition, which is supposed to make us all wealthy, is certainly some are getting wealthy, but others are being lost, as people point out. This is simply a chart of that, that you can see the movement here, and then the acceleration goes up steeper here. This is the famous middle class, the 60%, and it's pretty much disappearing, and of course you can't get lower than being poor. It's an explanation, I think a more important explanation of the hostility of the Western world. It's not hatred of our freedoms, which is what we often say, particularly about the Arab countries, but it's really a misuse of the wealth and the power that we have. The United States came out of the Second World War incredibly wealthy and powerful, and we could have done something else, but we continued under the theory that if the more we work harder, the more technical innovation, that the trickle-down theory will take care of the poor. This is just an example of the ratio, and again, you can see it's accelerating. So the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. We probably all know that, but I'm not sure we know that actually it's getting faster now. And by the way, the rich are now using more oil. In 1980, the ratio of United States usage of oil to everyone in the world, not just the OECD versus the rest of the world, but we used 6.9 times the energy of everyone else in the world. In the year 2000, we used 7.5. So the percentage of the energy resources we're taking is going up. So in summary of this is, I think the inequities accelerating. I believe it's based on fossil fuel consumption that when we talk about if oil prices go up, it'll hurt our economy will go in the tank. I'm never quite sure what these economies are like, living beings. They grow and shrink and get sick. But basically, it's, well, how much money you get. So if oil goes up, we get a lot less money and we get poorer, and that's what that means, that injuring our economy means to cut into the amount of resources we're taking. This is pure hypocrisy. We talk about this. We're trying to close the gap between the rich and the poor, and it's hypocrisy. We're not trying to increase the gap. We're just trying to get as much as we can, and that's sort of the result. But I believe it explains the eternal war on terrorism, and I think what we call our national security is how much energy can we consume. To me, there are no developing nations. There are just rich nations and poor nations. And the interesting thing, though, that we're going to be talking about is these developed rich nations are non-sustainable. And these developing third world nations are sustainable, or at least they have a much better chance of it. If the oil were to disappear, Bangladesh would hardly notice, but we would probably notice it. It'd be quite significantly. So this globalization, Murphy definition, unsustainable colonialization based on cheap oil. Now I'm going to talk about the nefarious OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. There's 11 member nations, the richer ones, principally Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar. The poor members are Indonesia, Iran, and Iraq, plus a few others. And these, by the way, are part of the rest of the world designation that I used earlier. Here they are. These are the African nations and the Middle East, and we talked about that earlier. Then we have over here Indonesia, that land that was occupied by the Dutch, I think, since roughly 1650, and Venezuela. This is the Big Ten to compare this because the whole question of oil reserves is critical. Of the top 10 nations, these five, all located right, bumping right next to each other, have this much oil, 658 million or billion barrels. And looking at the next, scattered down, you can see the difference. And here's a pictorial graph of it. Richard had a chart last night which showed the Earth and the bar graph. But this is the area. 65% of the world reserves are in that small handful of countries. These are the oil flows, which you can see these going to support, like here, out here to support Japan, who has no oil. Here you see Russia. We really haven't looked at how much Western Europe is becoming dependent on Russia. Between Russia here and the Middle East, the countries of Western Europe are extremely dependent. The United States is less dependent because we're eating a lot of it from Nigeria, from Venezuela, from Mexico, and from Canada. So I want to talk about the OPEC countries who are presumably quite wealthy. This is similar to the other chart with some a little more information added, like what's their oil income per capita? Because you kind of think of maybe these people are all driving Cadillacs and maybe getting $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. But if you put those together, you see that the oil income on a per capita basis for all of OPEC is $335 a year. That means the average person, that's what they're getting for this wealth bonanza. And all OPEC is $3,743. Places like Saudi Arabia stand out. I think their income is about $11,000 per year. But looking at this, bringing back for the other charts, we see the rest of the world, that income is $3,800. Basically, OPEC is a little bit poorer than all the rest of the world, China, India, when you lump all this together. So the situation is that the poverty in OPEC, it's historical and it's very important. Matthew Simmons is probably, next to Richard Heinberg, the leading authority on peak oil. He moves sort of in a different circle. He's on the advisory board to the Bush administration, and I don't think Richard's been invited yet. Maybe not, but probably soon, Richard. Yes. When they get Richard and Matthew Simmons on there together, then you'll see some action. But Matthew Simmons has been writing about this, and Matthew Simmons talks about at the beginning of the first administration, he had a long talk with Bush, and he says, you know, I have some severe problems about oil, and he explained this to Bush, and Bush says, well, you know, do what you have to do, like talk about it. And Matthew Simmons has been talking about it ever since. And he's pointed out that one of the horrible mistakes we made is to keep the price of oil as low as possible, and that meant that there was no way for these other countries to develop. And so their population's been growing. They can't live on local resources, and they continue to grow rapidly. And Osama bin Laden, he said a long time before he got really active that the Western powers owe the Arabs $36 trillion. I don't know where he got the number, but it was pointing out that paying $5 or $10 a barrel of oil was not enough for those nations when that's their principal industry to develop economically. Well, now we're at, I don't know, $49 today, and who knows what it'll be tomorrow. So are they going to have the opportunity now to optimize their resources? Now, Matthew Simmons says oil should be about $182 a barrel. I'm not quite sure how he gets that, but all us oil people are focused on oil. We use that, and we say, well, that's an interesting target, $182. What would that look like? Now, before we kind of do some of those calculations, I want to ask a little bit about what is the Carter Doctrine? Now, you may or may not recall that in the late 70s, when the oils had gone from roughly, in those dollars, $10 a barrel to $80 a barrel, that's in equivalent dollars today, Jimmy Carter came up with the famous Carter Doctrine. He says, the United States will use military force to protect our access to Middle East oil. But I never saw the quote, and I keep searching for this on the internet, and I keep finding the word cheap appears in here, that it's to protect our access to cheap Middle East oil. Because I think I think we could probably settle with Iraq and Saudi Arabia if we said, why don't you charge $300 a barrel and forgive us for all these transgressions? And they'd say, price, that's a good deal. We'll go with that. But who's going to set the price? Is it the OECD nations? Or is it going to be these OPEC monarchs and dictators, which are basically the OECD front people? Or is it going to be the people of the Persian Gulf? Now, unfortunately, those people are Shiites and Sunnis and Islamic fundamentalists is one way we look at them. And yet they probably look at it as they really like to be globalized capitalists and be able to charge what the market would bear for their oil. And what would that look like if we took the basic capitalistic free trade value and we came up with oil price of $182 a barrel and with natural gas scaling accordingly? And let's assume that's two-thirds of the energy use. There may be coal and nuclear power that aren't going to be influenced by these rising prices. In this case, for the OECD, their income would decline from $24,000 to about $20,000. And the OPEC people would increase from $3,700 to $11,000, which would be a real boon for them and probably very attractive, and would put them in a living conditions of about half of the OECD. So the increased cost of the OECD per capita is about $4,000, and the United States per capita is about $8,000. So 182 barrels of oil, and this is sort of a gross summary because maybe Venezuela wouldn't raise their price, or Nigeria, but it would mean each one of us might have to pay out $8,000 a year for oil simply because that price has gone up to roughly a dozen times what we've been used to paying for the last couple of years. Will the OECD citizens, that's us, will we pay this more per capita to OPEC, or will we just take control of the oil to maintain the price? And does the free market stop at this point? Will the war on terrorism go on forever? Actually, I've always thought when people say, you know, we're wasting all this money on aircraft carriers and things like that, we could have schools. But actually, we get tremendous benefit from being able to control the world. And we pay in the OECD world $500 per capita, and that could make a difference between, let's say, the $4,000 price hike should the Arab nations be able to charge what they want. Now, for me, the big question is, will the OECD sacrifice its own values and its own freedom for oil wealth? We have a situation that ever since 9/11, because we're at war with these people, that we are compromising many of the things that is really great about this country. We have the Patriot Act, and we have all kinds of things like stress against prisoners, which used to be called torture. And are we going to sacrifice that, and can the world move to some form of fascism to maintain a way of life? Will the Arabs remain subjugated till the oil is gone? Well, that's probably another 40 or 50 years. It doesn't look that way right now because the situation in Iraq continues to deteriorate, and there's just nothing but violence everywhere. We put this down simply to some extremists. By the way, if you look at oil shipments from Iraq, and there's a great chart in the Wall Street Journal, it says, well, they've been kind of going, but it's not too bad. Then you break that down to what are the Iraqi people getting? Well, the Iraqi people oil use is going like that because as there's some disruption and we want to maintain these shipments out, then they're living in just squalor. Their PPP has gone down to $1,500 a year, which is somewhere around Bangladesh or some other really poor country. There's 70% unemployment, and as I pointed out earlier, there's 100,000 people that have been killed in this war out of a pretty small nation. That's the equivalent of about 10 million Americans being killed if you normalize the populations in 18 months. So it's pretty serious over there. Will the OECD ever allow democratic Arab Islamic governments? The OECD really needs dictators to control that oil and not citizens. The Arab people recourse is, of course, revolution against the dictators. The Arabs, we point out that the Arabs, they're really too dumb to have democracy because they elected Mossadegh and he nationalized the oil industry, and that was a dumb move. So we realize that although they may have invented mathematics and they have these incredible societies, that the concept of one vote per person is beyond them. The 9/11 attack was basically by Saudi citizens. There were 19 hijackers, 15 of them were Saudis. I think there was one from Yemen and one from Oman. I'm not sure the other two. There were certainly no Iraqis and there were no Afghans involved. And to recall that, that Roosevelt authorized this Saudi dynasty, this dictatorship, forever in 1945. We don't talk about regime change in Saudi Arabia or setting a democracy there. So there's a big contradiction between capitalism and the need to control these prices. If the democratic Arab people, they want to enter the market and they'll charge what the traffic will bear, and that's going to have a major impact on our economy, which means your pocketbook. I want to just bring up one fallacious argument, because there's lots of ways to rationalize what we do, is we say, well, they would be foolish to raise prices, because if they did, we'd generate alternative energy development, and then where would they be? So that would be dumb, and we want to help them, because it's the white man's burden, we have to help people. So we want to keep them from making that very foolish move, because that foolishness might damage our economy. This is absolutely self-serving, because it again points out they're dumb, and also they're probably malevolent, because it's so obvious this wouldn't be wise if you do it, then you're just trying to hurt us. Now, presumably, in terms, if we believe what we say, we should welcome it. We say, raise the price to $200 a barrel, and, you know, 18 months, we'll just have windmills everywhere, and the cars will run on hydrogen. But I don't think that's the situation, nor does anyone in power. So the OPEC summary is that we've controlled, the Western powers have controlled Arab oil for decades. All these were, to a great extent, in Islamic lands, Indonesia, North Africa, the Middle East. It's not limited to Islam. We can consider Venezuela, who we don't like. Our most recent excursion really shows the battle plan. One of the things we've done, by the way, is we've really destroyed all their existing institutions. So we come in and say, we're going to have free market capitalism, and that goes, and that goes, and that goes, and all you people are fired, and we're going to install the neoliberal economics. We're going to repeat the Russian debacle. I don't know if you recall then when Russia finally said, well, this isn't working, we want to have the free market, the famous Jeffrey Sachs from Harvard went in there, took the whole country, everything, privatized it, and basically, in my view, they sort of sold it to the mafia. Now, in Russia, there have been an additional 10 million people have died during that period. The average lifespan of a Russian male is now 59 years old, down 7 years from where it was before this period. We have now a word called Hajis, which is we used to call the Viet Cong or the Slants or whatever. And what's really interesting, if you take this 100,000 deaths, then that's actually from some sources, and I can't quote this, it says that's more people than Saddam Hussein killed. You can run a country in a world by killing just, you know, a few thousand people. We sort of maintained our control in the South by lynching fairly small numbers of people. So I think Saddam was probably doing that. And now the words that we're now using is Fallujah is a cancer. And I recall in Vietnam, we have to destroy the village to save the village. So we're today, in fact, yesterday they said, well, the kill rate is 18 Americans and 600 insurgents, but we have no information on collateral damage, which means civilians. The Arab nations are just simply terrified. They've got to fight because it's just not tolerable. Now, does the future hold a nuclear oil war? We've adopted preemption. We say no other nations can have nuclear weapons except these United States and these countries. These countries didn't ask. They just went ahead and built them. North Korea is sitting there saying, if you attack and invade us, we'll just set off some nuclear bombs. And we said, oh, maybe we should negotiate. Iran may be the next target, and the posturing has already begun. Remember, we had weapons of mass destruction, which we didn't find, and now we say Iran's building a nuclear bomb. Iran says, no, we're not, and we say, proof positive, they're lying as well. A nuclear oil war, and Richard talked about this last night, it can or is being fought in the Middle East. The defeat's going to be measured in who controls oil. The attack defense is going to be on oil. And you can expect efforts to place nuclear mines in this area, the ultimate suicide bombing. Russia and China actions will be very significant. Ever since we invaded Yugoslavia, Russia, even though in poverty, has been somewhat desperately rearming. They provide a lot of offensive weaponry to both Iran and China. Would Russia provide nuclear bombs to Iran? Well, the OECD provided them to Israel, so although it looks like a heinous crime, it could be strategically something that could be done. And by the way, this is the strategic ellipse. Over 70% of all the resources are in the Middle East and Russia. And Russia's a big, big player here, and I think it also can perceive it could be next after Iran and Saudi Arabia. Again, there's no need any longer. We have these views of thousands of missiles bombing lots of sites, and I don't think that's going to happen. I believe if there's any nuclear war, it's simply going to be on the sources and distribution of fossil fuels. Imagine what destruction in the Saudi infrastructure would mean. All the oil fields are to the east, major populations to the west. Are we going to have inconvenience, or will it be panic? Are we going to have discomfort or starvation? There's a great book that I actually ordered called The Oil War of 1979 or something by Paul Erdman, and he actually hypothesizes a situation where the oil fields get bombed with nuclear weapons which had cobalt around and making them useless. Not to talk about too much war, but all these oil fields are right in here. You know, Saudi Arabia's got a lot of vast area, as does Iraq. They're very, very small areas. The time for the Sunburn missile flight system, which was designed by Russia and which Iran has them as well, Syria and China, 3 minutes from somewhere in Iran to Gawar, Gawar meaning the major oil field that produces half the oil that's shipped. So, and then Russia and China are involved in this. But one of the things that came out yesterday on a report is Saudi Arabia has cut no deals with any Western countries and lots of them with China. Iran has. So both Saudi Arabia and Iran, because they're seeing the handwriting on the wall, and they're going to look at this and say, well, those European people are pretty rough. They may do better with the Slavic people and the Chinese. So they're cutting those deals with them, and that's going to exacerbate tensions. So there's no guarantee that we're not going to have a World War III that's based on oil. So the contradictions are obvious. We're talking about democracy. We're not doing it. We're going to give up a lot of values after the election. Front page article, Wall Street Journal. 27 Americans now believe we should be using torture as a basic policy. Early peak oil could force some kind of conflict, single nuclear bomb on Gawar, and God knows what the price of gas would be. Russia might join OPEC and just say protect it. And now you're in a situation just like we had the Cold War for 30 years. Our scenarios, I think we can have OECD prevail by force. Middle East gets conquered completely. A lot of money's made. Peak oil will appear much faster with a steeper decline, and the inequity will accelerate. If you get the Persian Gulf prevail by war or bluff, huge dollar transfers to the Middle East, probably a world depression. In the Middle East, they probably won't be any smarter than we are, and they just won't prepare for their post-oil future. Now, there's another, and this kind of leads into the conference here. The other scenario is consumer restraint. It's kind of an option to this war. It's based on the Uppsala Protocol, and Richard touched on that last night, prepared largely by Colin Campbell, where we start cutting back. We have to start cutting back and match what we're using to what's available, and also let that be known to the world. No more secrets about things, but let's get it in there and start sharing. The world prices could maybe tie in with production cost, and people could start to allocate things, say, based on fairness rather than just on the market. And finally, it would be a lot less profiteering from shortages. Now, for me, and I'll talk a lot about this tomorrow, I think the final result is going to be a very low energy way of living, which is going to be either violently or we can get there peacefully. So we can manage the decline together, or we can use the Heinberg last one standing principle. This is one way to do it. I think oil depletion, in a certain sense, looking at the whole geopolitical nature of the world, could be a blessing. It could curtail the rampant consumption which in my opinion is this involved with buying and keeping everything going, is just driving us all crazy. The inequity is just growing so fast and so rapidly that it's hard to figure out that we can't address it someday. We can avoid constant war. We can save the climate. The latest reports that I read is there's a possibility of some aberration where things would suddenly accelerate. We'll change the physics of the atmosphere. And we get to save our freedoms. This is a tremendous nation. We've done great things in terms of democracies, and we start compromising this to maintain a high-energy way of life, I think we'll regret it. And also, we could leave some resources to our children, which is, I think, a good idea.
That was Pat Murphy, Director of Community Services, speaking at the first national conference on peak oil and community solutions, held earlier this month in Yellow Springs, Ohio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, 91.3 Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. We continue with more material from the First National Conference on Peak Oil and Community Solutions.
I want to thank Pat Murphy again for his presentation. We've kind of been going over these dark scenarios that may come about, and that's because we really understand the challenges that we face, which we all know is really important. But really, this conference from now on is going to be focusing on solutions. So let's put away all those scenarios and focus on the scenario that we want to move towards, and that's the third scenario, the consumer restraint. Another way is changing our lifestyles, and we all know that we have the choice to change our lifestyles, and we don't make that choice every 4 years. We make that choice every single day of where we're spending our money, where we're getting the goods and services where we live. So let's always keep that in mind, and now look forward to the future in a hopeful way. So I'm really honored to introduce David Bloom here.
Well, while we're getting settled, I'll just say a few things about myself, and then we'll get started. I've been working on issues about energy since the late 70s, and in the meantime, I've ranged around in quite a few different subjects. For the last few years, I've been teaching permaculture around the world, which is a good toolbox to accomplish the very things that Richard's been talking about what we need to do to prepare for a lower-level energy lifestyle. But in my former life, before I started teaching permaculture and being an organic farmer for 10 years, I was teaching farmers and others how to produce alcohol fuel to be able to run their vehicles, run their generators, etc. And I did a 10-part PBS series on alcohol fuel back in 1983, which I'll mention a little later. And I don't see any clocks here, and I'm not wearing a watch, so if somebody can give me the 5-minute warnings and stuff, that would be good. So I'm going to give you a very different message today. I mean, at this point, most people in the room should be relatively depressed, you know, over the state of the world. It's basically, well, things are winding down and we should all make the best of it. And there's no doubt at all that we have to implement severe conservation, really examine how we use materials and products and limit the way we go about that. But we are clever monkeys, and there are things we can do working with nature to be able to alleviate some of these problems. And those are the things you're not hearing about in the press. And there's a long history of that. When the first cars were invented, they didn't run on gasoline. They ran on alcohol. Average everyday moonshine. Gasoline hadn't been invented yet. Oil was the province of heating and lighting homes. This is what Rockefeller's main business was. And there was this whole section of what he had taken out of the ground that he had distilled that he had to throw away because it tended to make oil lamps explode and nobody really wanted it. And that's what nowadays is called gasoline.